Hello and welcome to the Ogre Cave Audio Report, recording on February 16th, 2006. This is Mike Sugarbaker. I apologize in advance to our listeners for my vocal issues this week. I have a bit of a bug. Hopefully we won't have too many other bugs technically this week. Because it's on, we have, well, I'll let the others introduce themselves.
No, you can go ahead without us. This is Alan Sugarbaker.
This is Chris Hanrahan.
Aldo Ghiazzi.
Yep, we've got a guest, Aldo Ghiazzi of Impressions Advertising and Marketing.
Yes, who has his fingers in many pies, but we're going to be focusing, I think, on the distribution questions, which I know Chris has many of. And but before we jump into all that, do we want to get kind of the general, you know, get your CV from you as far as starting out with Wingnut and where you went from there?
Well, yeah, back in 1993, just a buddy of mine just did what any other person, you know, who's a gamer did. They thought they could make a game better. And me and a buddy of mine just got together and made a card game just at our local Kinko's and went to a local game convention and started selling it. Next thing you know, distributors were finding me. And I just started making games part-time just and had a full-time job just like most game publishers have. Mm-hmm. So about 6 years ago, I attempted to do it full-time, and then in about like 2 months realized, I can't do it. And so I started jumping into trying to help game companies doing marketing and sales, which was my background when I used to work in the video game industry. So if anybody remembers Wizard's Attic and what they were as a company, you know, they were what was called a fulfillment consolidator. They took a whole bunch of small companies and did the sales and shipping to game distributors for them. Well, I started that with a couple of friends of mine, Steve from Trollor Games, and then at the time, Rob Stone from Citizen Games when they were around, and took my little Wingnut, and we made our triumvirate to start Impressions. And basically after that, Wizard's Attic started going down.
Yeah, I witnessed that firsthand. That was
we
exciting.
All did. But, you know, he had something like 100 companies that he was representing. Mm-hmm. And basically, towards the end, I just called him up, and I said, and I only had a couple dozen clients at that time, but I called up Eric and said, who owns Wizard's Attic, and said, hey, Eric, why don't I just take them all over for you and transfer all the rights? And basically, we did that, and ta-da, Impressions. So Wingnut really took a back seat, and full-time job from the hours of whatever to whatever, I work on Impressions. It's what I do full-time for the games industry.
Right on. Right on. You've really been in this game since 93?
93 was when we made the first game. So, I mean, part-time,
yeah.
93. I mean, what? My buddy and I were 22. We were just out of college, you know, and we just made a game. You know, and then we made a second game with the leftover paper from the first game, actually. you know, we were like, oh, we got leftover paper, what should we do? And then we just made a game. So we had two games in the pipe and, you know, made a few $100 a month, but again, there was nothing, anything groundbreaking actually until Battle Cattle came along. And as silly as it sounds, Battle Cattle was huge for me, with different editions, minis, expansions, and licensed game to Steve Jackson. I mean, huge in a little company sense. So yeah. People just got to know Wingnut because of Battle Cow.
Well, whenever you say something is huge in our industry, you have to kind of put it in quotes. But you know.
Yeah, I mean, huge in quotes, definitely.
Well, I'm wondering if we could talk a bit about, just very generally, about what Impressions is and what it does. This is going to be an industry-heavy show, and I find that stuff pretty interesting. I think all four of us do.
Well, I think for the listeners, most of them are going to be consumers, and chances are, if they're gamers, they're gamers that want to make a game or have already made one. And I just got off a thread on RPGNet, which the thread's now like 6 pages long, which got into talking about how to market and promote and, you know, evangelize your game, which is, to answer your question, what Impressions does, which is hopefully we do that. But the bulk of what we do is really we work for about 50 game companies, and the distributors call us to order products from each 50-odd game companies all under one roof. And so they get one shipment, one invoice, and then they write one check for all these different game companies. Just like Chris, who works at a retailer, he called up a distributor and says, I want 300 companies. So we just do it for a really, really small slice of the marketplace. And so we handle their warehousing, their sales, their shipping, and then we, of course, help them, if they want to market or promote or try to get deals or, strategize, how to get their name out there.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Aldo.
It's all about distributor access.
I have a question for you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, good.
Okay, good. When a distributor, any of them, name your poison, it doesn't matter. Did I say poison? when they order from Impressions, are they ordering Impressions or are they ordering from you by line? Because that's actually kind of an important distinction that I've always wondered.
So if they order by line or by what?
Or from you as a whole. So let's say somebody calls you up to get Weapons of the Gods.
Yeah, which has been a great seller.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love the game. When a distributor orders from you, are they ordering by the manufacturer who produces Weapons of the Gods, or are they ordering everything from all the people you carry at once from Impressions?
Yes, when somebody places an order, it's just like you as a retailer. As long as you meet my minimum, whatever that blanket minimum, which is 36 units, which, all they have to do is they can call me up and order one copy from 36 different companies, like one product from one
right.
company, one from another, and as long as it meets 36, I'll ship it to them. So the theory is that any distributor out there, if they have this such breadth of choice, they can actually have a retailer like you, for example, and say, hi, I need one copy of Weapons of the Gods. And if that distributor doesn't want to carry it, except one copy to know that they're going to sell to you, they can call me up and say, hey, put one copy in with my order of Weapons of the Gods.
I think the question I'm trying to get at, though, is when that distributor calls you, are they ordering? Many distributors order on a cycle. So, for instance, if they're out of Chessex, they only order Chessex dice for every 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
They're going to be out of Chessex dice for 2 weeks. So when a distributor is ordering from you and you're carrying brands X, Y, and Z, are they ordering brands X, Y, and Z on the same at the same time, or do they order by line on different dates?
Oh, no. They order me all at one time. Like, Impressions,
okay, that's
distributed. Impressions is seen as like one single entity from the distributor. Even though every company we represent is in their system as an independent company, they still keep
right.
their identity. But distributors have created a subcode in their system for consolidators like myself that says, hey, I want to look up EOS Press, Weapons of the Gods, and see everything EOS does. Great. Oh, look, they're an Impressions client. Or they can go the opposite and say, let's show me all the Impressions clients, and they'll see EOS, Toy Vault, Troll Lords, Goodman. They'll see all of them. So Alliance, actually, if you want to talk specifically about a distributor, Alliance is a big game distributor out there. They actually preface every single of my clients' codes with an IMP for Impressions. So
right.
retailers like you can actually know that they're an Impressions client, and I even have retailers call me all the time saying, hey, Aldo, can you tell me what's going on with this? So.
Yeah. One of my biggest concerns recently has been that the large distributors, there's a couple of them in the country, since they do order in a cyclical nature, things that go out of stock may be out of stock for a while. I was hoping...
I know what you're about to say because the cycles, there's two different types of cycles actually right now. Alliance has an every 4 week ordering cycle for, I would guess, 90% of their vendors. The top 10, 15 get restocked every 2 weeks. So for example, I think like of course Wizards of the Coast, Wizards Kids are probably like every week, but like Reaper and Chessex Dice, those are every 2 weeks. Impressions is on an every 4 week cycle. But that 4 week cycle is not like it's set in stone. I mean, if they desperately need 20 copies of something, they put in what's called a spot restock. It's for the really hot titles. Like I got it with Troll Lords, Castles, and Crusades. I get it with Goodman's Dungeon Crawl Classics. I get it with Toy Vault. I got it with Weapons of the Gods. They're Run for Your Life, Candyman from Snark and Dagger. These are my hot sellers where they said, oh, well, let's buy it. Because it's another board game, we'll buy it like any other board game. and then one out of 10 products becomes a big hit. And, I mean, the distributors took the chance to buy heavy numbers. You know, the chance of a game selling heavy is like 1 out of 10. So they don't want to get caught with their pants down 9 out of 10 times. But, like, a lot of the other distributors, most of them try to restock the impressions line every week, which is kind of like a just-in-time, which is good and bad all rolled into one. That's a whole other conversation, you know. But just-in-time tries to make you, the retailer, happy, just like the every 4-week cycle with spot restocks tries to make the retailers happy. And which one is better, I don't know. I work with both of them and get them the stuff whenever they need it.
Do you find, although the fledgling companies that, back when I was working at RPGNet actively and had our office down at Wizard's Attic, every single day, Eric Rowe would be on the phone advising some small company on how to get started and whether or not they were quite at the level where they needed his services and such. Do you field a lot of those types of calls these days, or has that slowed down in the current economic environment?
Yeah, is anybody still trying to get started?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, my wife laughs at me all the time because she hears me with the same speech all the time, and she's like, you just talk less, you know, to these people, you know, because they're not clients yet. And I'm like, well, no, you know, these people don't know what they're getting into when they think it's quite simply, you know, oh, I'm going to make a game, you know, feel the dreams, if I build it, they will come. I'm just so not a believer in that. You know, that just does not happen.
When people accuse, they accuse Steve Jackson every year at GTS of just trying to slam the door on people that really should not be in the industry and aren't ready for the realities. Are you being accused of that at all?
Well, I like to call myself a realist. Some of my clients actually call me a pessimist and glass half empty and all that. But I try to explain to people. I mean, right now, like, let's take the RPG market specifically. I mean, we all know D20 just went a bust, you know, after the flood of product that was in the market and open gaming license and all that. Even now that it's quote-unquote settled down, RPGs just sell small, small amounts. And the only way I found even my clients or non-impression clients to really make up for it is a mix between online sales, which have gone up for practically every RPG client I've spoken to. I mean, their online sales are sometimes bigger than the checks I write them for wholesale, which is scary. It shouldn't be. And then, of course, PDF sales. I mean, James at RPG Now and Drive Through and E23 does it as well. Now Pazzo's getting into it. And then, of course, print on demand. You know, print on demand makes it, you know, no inventory, you have less chance of going out of business, you can print 100 copies if you have 100 people buying.
Mm-hmm.
But the RPG market stinks right now, and quite honestly, even though the calls have lessened, it's still people trying to get in and not realizing that to sell 1,000 copies, let alone 500 copies of a role-playing game these days, is extremely hard. You know, and when I say these numbers, I'm just talking strictly distribution channel. You know, sell to a distributor, go to a retailer, consumer buys off retailer shelf. I'm not talking direct sales, I'm not talking convention, I'm not talking PDF sales.
Yeah, if you can hand sell 500 of them, then you've got a hell of a lot of time on your hands, or you're going to a ton of conventions.
You know, some things, I mean, there are so many different paths people could take. I mean, even with, you know, the PDF and the print on demand as an option and online sales and everything, people can start selling, can sell direct to retailers too. You know, there's so many choices people could have, and distribution used to be a huge golden chalice. And of course, I still believe in distribution because I love the mass quantities that could possibly come out of it. But it's tough right now for new companies to get into the distribution channel and be recognized.
Well, speaking of distribution, right. Yeah, Chris, go ahead. I was going to prompt you.
The distributors right now are, you know, and rightly so, are insanely risk-averse. You know, the numbers, all the retailers are just really super unhappy. Our fill rates are just abominable. And, you know, we're part of the problem most of the time by not placing pre-orders ourselves, but we'll go out of stock on an item for weeks at a time now rather than just a week.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to say there, but it's a problem in general.
Well, I mean, it's a catch-22. You brought up pre-order. The pre-order system, pre-orders used to be God in the industry. When I first started Wingnut Games, and I would get pieces of paper from these distributors ordering, you know, hundreds of my little games before they were even printed, was just so cool. I'm like, look, free money, yay! You know, I mean, that was great. But now, if I call up some of the distributors, and if they tell me they have 12 on pre-order, I'm practically doing cartwheels. Because that means that 12 is going to turn into, you know, whatever exponent that they're going to use to buy, you know, how many copies. But, you know, again, I'm dealing with medium to small-sized companies, so to expect large numbers, you know, it's not very common. But, you know, I'm sure people, you guys pre-order your War Machine and your Wizards of the Coast stuff and your WizKids stuff and all that other stuff. But, you know, the small press is kind of like, you know, we're lucky to get some scraps from a retailer who 80% of their business is, you know, WizKids, Watson Games Workshop, you know, Rio Mayfair.
Yeah.
But I understand where you guys are coming from because, one, I personally think that there's so many SKUs out there that how can you guys keep track of them, let alone stock everything?
Right. So, we don't try.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole days of full-line game stores and full-line distributors, I think it's not that there aren't any. I think that there aren't any because nobody can just keep track of it to be full-line, you know, that there's much out there.
There's more products now than there's ever been before. You know, it's not...
Maybe even with the D20 boom.
I would say so.
Especially board games.
Well, if you think about it, I'm not even speaking of products that is sold through stores. You've got so many products coming in so many different forms of media to the consumer that, man, there's just so much out there for the luxury dollars to extend into.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
No, I definitely agree on that. I mean, I wish retailers would use the pre-order system, but I completely understand why you don't. And I think
why do you think we don't?
I think you don't for two reasons. And I just spoke to Don Rentz, who owns Chessex Dice, today about this. He's going to be at DunderCon tomorrow, so we were talking about things. And one of the biggest things he said, which I agree with him, is that over the years, publishers/manufacturers have just missed street dates so often that you guys are like,
yeah,
6 months later going, well, 3 months ago I wanted 30 copies, but now the fuzz is gone, I only need 6, and you guys would get
hit
with product that you don't need. So it's kind of a trust issue has been lost, and publishers try. I mean, trust me, used to be a publisher, you know, I know what it's like. I mean, I promised one of my Tom Jolly games in December, and it didn't make it till KubaCon in May, you know. And there's just so many issues, and you try and try, but, you know, we're one-man shows, you know. But, again, I wish you'd use pre-order systems, but there's not much of an incentive for you to use it. And,
well, it's interesting. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Centurion Hobby Distributors, I think they're on the East Coast, they were one of the only distributors that gave retailers incentive for an extra discount for pre-ordering in their online system. And it just, I mean, it worked, but it didn't work, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And I think my biggest complaint isn't street dates slipping, because that's kind of, street dates aside from WotC, WizKids, and the White Wolf folks are essentially just a joke. So I don't think even the consumers really believe them anymore, so I don't have as much concern. I think my biggest concern is lack of information on product. You know, I sometimes have at best a one-sentence description of a $25 product, and that doesn't do it, you know. It's the communication from the manufacturing side sometimes is poor to none, and it's really hard to, spend dollars in that area when you don't even know what you're spending.
I think that's
a big problem.
No, and I agree with you, and that's actually one thing I'll little, you know, to my own horn as impressions, that I really hit my clients over the head saying, look, you need to give the distributors 3 months advance notice on this. Why? Well, because they need a picture, they need a description, they need a price, they need time for the retailer to generate questions or do research, and even then for you as the publisher to figure out what your strategy is going to be to hype this product for the 3 months. And then, of course, eventually, hopefully, hit your release date. Because when I put a product into the system of all the distributors, it has to have a picture, has to have the price, has to have a 3 to 5 sentence description, you know, product code. There's even a sub-description as what is it, a D20 role-playing game? Is it a, you know, a non-collectible card game? Is it a box board game? Whatever. So the hope is that you get as much description as possible. And that's why when I blanket things through impressions, hopefully, quote unquote, I'm doing things right for you, the retailer, and for them, the distributor, to give you the most information. And sometimes a brand new company may forget, maybe I should tell them it's D20, or maybe I should tell them it's a non-collectible card game, you know, when their description may not say anything. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we try, and I extend this to all retailers too, like, just like you and Aaron. You know, does that at your store as well. It calls me, see all of them. I know you deal with it. Can you answer a question? And hopefully
yeah.
I'm there for you guys. You know, so hopefully no impressions clients, or very few impressions clients, you know, are part of that problem for you.
Give props where props are due. I think we've managed to sell 5 copies of Weapons of the Gods at this point, and that's fantastic for a game that couldn't have had a huge print run. We're not talking like Shadowrun levels or, you know, any White Wolf product. So I sold a bunch of White Wolf products. So the word had gotten out there and it was done well. So good work.
Well, for Weapons of the Gods specifically, I can't quote any numbers for any of my clients, but I can tell you they have a little printing secret with one of the partners. So they printed a lot of that.
Oh, did they?
Woo. And I have a lot in my warehouse, and I was really scared when I got that, a lot of books. But after the first, 2 weeks when the restocks started coming in, I was like, no problem, no problem. I will hold this inventory and I will sell it. Because it has not stopped. And Weapons of the Gods was selling since what? November? I think? November, October?
You so don't want to hear this, too, because we sold 5 copies, but we went through weeks and weeks and weeks of out of stocks with that product.
And Aaron told me.
Yeah, and we were so bummed because it had built such a great buzz, and, you know, we had people coming in and looking for it, and eventually they moved on, you know?
Yeah, and actually, I can tell you one of the reasons that gives you the delay, take in consideration, too, that, you know, when a distributor puts in an order, you're familiar with this with like Wizards of the Coast and Wizards, your street date. Well, I actually set street dates for all my client stuff, and I ship almost every week to the distributors. So when I ship, every distributor Monday through Thursday has a set ship day because it's spreading things out so everybody gets it at the same time. So there are some times where even though a distributor may put in an order for Weapons of the Gods as part of their order of food stuff, I can't ship them all of that stuff until a certain date because of street date of the new stuff.
Right.
So there is some delay on my end, but it shouldn't be weeks at a time. I mean, you know,
I know.
You know, a lot of the distributors restock every single week, even if it could be just a minimum because they're trying to do the just in time to keep you guys happy. The problem is.
Oh, I know.
The problem is, and I say this not maliciously to the distributors, but the dollars are just not there for them to buy very cheap. You know, and risk like they used to. So it's kind of a bum, but like, I called up, I'll tell you, ACD Distribution specifically, when I saw their order for Weapons of the Gods, I called them back and I said, look, I never try to pump you on stuff, but you really need to order more. And he goes, okay, Aldo, I believe you, you don't do this. And he doubled the order. And he still had to order more next week. So it's nice to see a success in the midst of, you know, a lot of RPGs that really don't sell so much.
Definitely. Definitely.
You've given a lot more guidance to products coming out. When I was working with you doing impressions things and editing Game Buyer and such, Game Buyer was a great tool that you used to help hype them and remind retailers that products were coming out. Still doing great things with it with the retailer reviews, which I think is pretty unique.
Oh, yeah. Those have been great.
And I've seen over and over again you communicating with your clients saying, you know what, we got to push your release back a little bit because we have to remind people that it's coming, and you haven't spent enough time doing that.
Yeah. And a lot of people feel once they get the product in hand, they immediately just, ooh, I got to get it out to everybody. And like I said, it's that field of dreams. It's like people say will come. And like I said, 99 times out of 10, you roll the dice, it's not going to happen. But if a lot of consumers won't know what you mean by Game Buyer, because Game Buyer is a business-to-business publication only for retailers.
Right, so it goes directly to the retailers.
It just gets sent directly to the retailers, and it talks about a lot of dry marketing and sales tools that retailers can hopefully use to sell more of the products. And the retailer review that Alan referred to was, quite honestly, I stole it from the business-to-business pub I was working at in the video game industry. We used to review video games based off of sales potential as to how much money it will make the retailer, and that's how our reviews are. It's all reviewed by retailers, and Aaron from Endgame is one of my reviewers, who says, you know, buy this game because I've seen so much marketing on the website. They've sent me demos. I have kits. I have posters. It looks great on my shelf. They picked a good box, or they didn't pick a good box.
And he may not necessarily be a fan of the game, but he may think it'll move, and that's why those reviews are unique.
Yeah. Yeah, every other website and magazine reviews a game on, it's great, it's fun, it plays well, it doesn't have great rules. Gameplay is such a minute factor in game buyer reviews, because quite honestly, you can slap, you know, let's say a license on, you know, huge license like Star Wars, whatever, you know, Star Trek, and put it on a really awful game, and chances are you're still going to sell a lot just because of the license. And that's where, you know, that's how we view reviewing games in Game Buyer. And Game Buyer is available to all publishers and distributors and retailers. So if people are publishing products out there, you know, Impressions has Game Buyer, and we can send it to them, you know, for free, and no subscriptions or anything. You know, people can, you know, talk to us about what you're doing to help move the product off the retailer store shelves, and that's the, you know, what is it, the Epitaph of the magazine, or the, you know, that's the crux of the magazine.
That'll be great.
Helping Chris make more money.
Excellent. I can back that up.
Hopefully.
Although this is an idea that I'm pretty sure this is an idea I stole from you long ago. But again, on the idea of bringing in the strategies from video game journalism and borrowing what we can from there.
Yeah.
That consumer oriented video game magazines are all about previews.
Oh, yeah.
It's all about how great the game is going to be when it comes out in, you know, 8 months.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And I'm wondering what is currently standing in the way of, I mean, we've been talking about how, you know, publishers are not getting enough information out there about their products before they come out. What are the tools that are out there for that are not being used yet? What's, like, the first step that a publisher can take to start delivering the information to the consumer?
Well, actually, RPGNet, the Business Marketing Publishing Threat Forum, there's a six-page thread that turned into talking about Game Buyer reviews to talking about exactly what you were talking about. Chad from Atomic Sock Monkey? Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Sorry, Chad. But he brought up saying the same thing, and I think a guy named Ash as well, out there. And I said to him, I said, you can do print on demand. First off, you can, once you're finished with your book, and let's say you send it to a traditional printer to get printed 4 weeks from the day, go to a print on demand place and say, hey, can you get me 6 copies and ship them to these 6 people? And you send them in advance to all these people. So that's one thing. PDFs, obviously, are the next easiest thing, because you just email a PDF the same day you email it to the printer. You don't get to feel the book, but you can still, for an RPG, send it. Now, I do know, and Alan knows this from helping me with the Tom Jolly games through Wingnut, is that we got advanced copies from China, and we took them to conventions, we showed them to people physically at shows, and said, here, check it out, the game's not going to be shipped to me for another 2 months. And we used those to try to, you know, build hype. But I got to tell you, one of the biggest things that I think any company needs to do, which many don't because full-time job gets in the way, is that they need to go to conventions. Conventions are huge. I mean, you have a 100% target market, like DunderCon this weekend. They're all gamers. you know, and you should be there bringing samples of your game, running demos, even if it's not done, hitting a booth, you know, while somebody else runs, things like that. Heck, I did it with Alan. I told Alan, go run demos. I'll sit here at the booth. You know, hopefully you'll bring me sales, you know, when we were doing the Tom Jolly stuff. You know, and it doesn't work in great magnitude, but to me it's still the best way. This is a crazy, crazy concept. But imagine if you got your 1,000 copies. And let's go back to the Field of Dreams. You know, if they build it, you know, they will come. Everybody wants to get it out so fast that everybody's going to hopefully buy it. But let's say you make your 1,000 copies of your board game, card game, or whatever. Don't ship it to distribution immediately, or don't ship it to consumers. Get, you know, some of those copies out to reviewers and to key people. Wait a month for their reviews to go up and their buzz to generate, and the fact that they were one of, you know, 100 people that got your new game, to hopefully build this hype, and then at the end of the month, you then ship it out, hopefully building something. And you're, of course, building it in conjunction with what? Online ads, print ads, you know, convention visits, PR, forum posts, all the other things that are under the marketing umbrella. But that, to me, as wild of a concept as it sounds, I mean, that is great to do. Hold the stuff. Get the buzz. Send sample copies to Chris at Endgame. Hey, Chris, sending you an advanced copy of this. Even if you need to put demo copies stickered on it so he doesn't put it on his shelf and sell it, you know, or, you know.
It's amazing how few people send advanced demos to retailers.
You know how expensive it is, though? You got to feel for people. Imagine sending 100 copies at $2 or $3, you know, a pop in the mail. But let's get on my realist hat. You got to do what you got to do to be successful. And if a few $100 is going to stop you, you shouldn't try in the first place.
You know,
but that's a little extreme comment. I mean, of course you should always try, but, you know. You shouldn't whine about it. How's that? You shouldn't say, oh, well, I can't send $300 worth of samples out there, man. I need to sell them. Well, you need to build samples into your print run. I always allow 10% of my print run when I budget for sample copies. So, I mean, if I print 2,000 copies of a game, 200 are set aside for damages, sample copies, reviewers, promo copies to my buddies, you know, things like that. And then I work my numbers to say, can I make money off of, you know, the remaining 1,800?
It is very expensive to send out sample copies. I mean, you know, if you think about how many retailers there are out there, I think the wild ass estimate is 5,000 or something like that. Imagine paying postage on 5,000 copies of anything if you can even print 5,000 to begin with. But a more realistic thing to do that I wish I would see more manufacturers use is the distribution chain to get out, you know, even flyers about their games. You know, pay the distributors X amount of dollars to put that in each box, and you're going to touch.
The distributors will do it for free, Chris.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying, you know, throw them a bone, buy them a latte or something, you know, and get them to do it. I just don't understand why they're not trying to touch, you know, 5,000 new clients. It just makes no sense.
I got to tell you, 90% of the email/conversations I have with people about their game, and, I mean, I preface this by saying, of course, you should be this proud of your game, but everybody tells me how great their game is and how different it is. And I think, first off, yes, I'm sure your game is great, but what are you going to do to make people find out that it's great? I mean, again, we go back to Field of Dreams. You know, I built.
And how do you know whether anybody but you and your friends will think it's great?
Exactly.
Nobody's doing market research.
You know, let alone why would Chris buy something that he has no knowledge of and bring it to a store when he can just bring in another copy of Settlers of Catan that he knows he's going to sell? You know, it's that, and then people don't think about getting the word out there. They think if they build a website and make a game that people are going to magically find their website and post on it and grab the downloads. But wait a minute, how are people going to know that there are downloads, you know, unless you tell them where to go to get these downloads and, you know, sample pictures of the game or quick start rules are another great thing to give out for free. But again, this all goes back to conventions in my mind. You know, go to conventions, go to local game stores. You know, Gosh, Steve Stroller James is flying out from Arkansas to San Francisco for DenverCon, and it's an 1,800-person show. Joseph Goodman's flying from Chicago to San Francisco for DenverCon, and it's, you know, it's Zev from Z-Man Games. He flies every stinking regional show in existence, and he is the king of conventions, and he's built the success out of it. You know, get on the road and travel and get in front of the people.
That makes some money?
Huh?
That makes some money. I mean, my impression is that if you're a small to medium publisher and you're going to lots and lots and lots of conventions, sooner or later the cost of doing that is going to become overwhelming.
Well, yes, but unless you're smart, you know, unless you're smart, you don't know how many times I've gone to Origins and Gen Con and even the Gamma Trade Show, and I see these first-time publishers getting, you know, one or two booths at $800 a pop and having them and their wife slash girlfriend and their artist and their editor and their best friend and their brother manning the booth, and nobody comes by.
Yeah, well, if you build it, they will come.
You know, they're paying for four people to fly or to eat or to sit in a hotel. Man, I'm so cheap when I was doing Wingnut. I would share booths, half booths with people. I would share hotel rooms with three others and shift city sleeping on the floor.
That's what you have to do.
Dude, I skip lunch. This is my big thing I did in a seminar at the Gamma Trade Show last year. I made a comment at a seminar about how to succeed, and one of the things was this, you know, get a half table, you know, share with somebody, get somebody to rep you, don't fly everybody out, all these little nuances. And one thing I said was skip lunch, because if I'm not there for an hour, I have a chance of not making money. And this gal that was in the audience at the seminar, actually after the seminar, somebody came to me when I was at my booth where I was hanging out, and she brought me lunch. She bought me a cheeseburger and fries and said, "This is for you because you don't have lunch. Thank you for the seminar." So it was kind of cool that that little stupid thing, you know, got to somebody. But it's so true. You know, Steve and Joseph, actually, from Goodman Games, the only reason they even come out here and make it worth it to get on an airplane is because, one, they ship all their products to me to hold for them, and two, they stay at my house, so there's no hotel expense. So, they, you know, even guys who do it full-time like them are still saving money and shaving expenses every single place they can. It's what we do to stay in business, but we love games. You know,
you mentioned GTS, and I know Chris is jumping up a bit too.
I just got something here for you because I think it's really interesting. You were saying that Zev goes to every show. You know, that's what he does, right?
This year, though, really burnt out.
and I find it interesting because we're going to talk about GTS right now, and that's one of the shows he's not going to.
Yeah, he actually. I can tell you quote for quote with Zev and I are good friends without, I know he'll have no ill will with what I'm repeating from what he said to me because he posted it on the forum.
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, the reason he's not going is just because when he goes to the show, either A retailer has already consciously decided not to carry his products because they don't do border card games, or B, the retailer carries his stuff and sells it. So he says that the amount of new business he gets at GTS because he's been going for so long is negligible. So for right now, he doesn't feel he needs to go versus the cost to be gone making games and paying for the booth and doing it on his own. Not that the Gamma Trade Show is not valuable to him. It's helped build his business over the years, but just right now it's like, well, he feels he's saturated things. You know,
what is your opinion on the Gamma Trade Show these days? I know you used to say it was essential, but you also weren't a member of Gamma at the time.
Well, I'm still not a member. I've never been a member of Gamma, and that doesn't say anything against Gamma, except the fact is I'm cheap. Let's go back to saving money. Why, you know, I mean, I don't know. Let's keep on, you know, with the Gamma stuff. I'm just cheap. You know, let's just go there and leave it at that. I still think the Gamma Trade Show is huge for game publishers, and that most game publishers underutilize that show. That show, they actually were salespeople, which most publishers aren't because they're gamers and they're more creative people. If they utilize the show for what it was, they could really make money at it because everybody thinks it's a money pit because you don't sell. For the listeners out there that don't know, it's a trade show. You don't make any money. You sit at a booth and you just spend money until you don't have any more. You know, but you hope that retailers are going to order your product when they get home. But you can actually take orders at that show and really convince retailers, either by incentives or just because of your great sales ability, to get them to say, yes, I will put me down for six and order it through ACB or Alliance. And here's a little piece of paper that says it. And people don't use that, you know?
You have totally, totally hit the nail dead center on the head.
Well, I mean...
That is absolutely how I feel about that show, is that you have a bunch of people who don't necessarily have the skill set to be at a trade show in the first place, treating it like a con booth, when really, you should be there taking orders. You know, that's that, and explaining the game to a retailer who's then going to try and sell it for you.
Yeah.
And it's just not there. I mean, I would say a good 80% of the people at that show just don't know that's what they're supposed to be doing there.
I was actually just going to say only 10% know that they're supposed to do that.
So Watsy's big. Watsy's really big, so I'm giving them like a full 5%. I'm giving WizKids like another full 5%, even though in the past I don't think they've known that either. But
well, they're, I think, at the upper echelon where they just show up because, you know, retailers just need to feel the warm fuzzy of what they're doing. You know, but I got to tell you, one of my clients, and I'm not, you know, shooting their horn or anything, but they are the best example I can think of. Merc and Dagger, the guys who do Hex, Dead Hand Chaos Poker, and Run for Your Life Candyman, he is by far what everybody should follow at the Gamma Trade Show. He's got the perfect demo situation, he's got the great convention presence, and he knows what gear to shift into when he's at a trade show versus a consumer show. And last year, I told all my clients, take orders, tell people to buy, give them an incentive, send them free products, whatever you want, just get the orders and let's pile them up. I had clients who got a couple of dozen orders here, a couple of dozen from other clients. Kurt came back to me from Smirk and Dagger, and this was before Dead Hand Poker launch. He had over 200 copies and orders of Dead Hand, and nearly 200 in Hex, which was already out. And that is just unbelievable for a small press company. Small press companies can't even sell 200 copies of their role-playing game.
And you know? I'm gonna say I totally agree with you on his booth, because when I was there, I was totally down and ready for Chaos Poker. He just did such a great job with it, you know.
Oh, and so. Candyman. Oh, you should have seen him with Candyman at Origins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for that consumer show, he had gingerbread cookies that were real gingerbread cookies that you could bite off their limbs, just like you usually cut them off in the game. And
nice.
You know, he just had stacks of the Candyman looking great, and him and his partner just demo great. And you know, the advantage Kurt has is nobody may know this, but Kurt's real full time job, he's a marketer. he does marketing for a living. So
nice.
But, so he has an advantage.
It shows in his products. I mean, all of his products are excellent products, and I almost never get the chance to say this. A couple of his products, namely, I think, Run for Your Life Candyman, are actually better products than they are games.
Yeah.
You know, it's always, well, you have a great game, but you have no idea how to make a thing that somebody will want to buy, or you don't really have either one. I almost never get to say, well, the game's kind of iffy, but you've packaged it and done everything to it that you could possibly do to make people want it.
You know, and let's actually segue that into what I tell a lot of people when they're about to make a game. Your game should always have a shtick. You know, I don't care what the shtick is, just make sure it's a shtick. And a shtick is not, oh, it's a new magic system, or it's a new genre, crossing two genres. I mean, a shtick is like, with Candyman, he just mocked Candyland. There's a shtick. You know, another shtick with Smirk and Dagger is Dead Hand Chaos Poker. There's the Texas Hold'em thing. He took and made a twist on poker. You know, he took a regular poker deck and made poker games with a twist. Heck, Battle Cattle, let's get back to me in the beginning. You know, Battle Cattle, the name of the game was made first because it rhymed. Then we made the game. We're like, let's make a game called Battle Cattle. It just sounds good. And that was our shtick. And then, like, the next week, we were watching Monty Python and the Quest of the Holy Grail, and the cow got shot over the castle, and ta-dum, we said, oh, cows and the battle cattle, and then we'll play Car Wars. Oh, it'll be Car Wars with cows. But we named the game first. So I always tell people, if you can get a stick, troll or game, their stick is Jerry Gygax. No matter what anybody thinks, Jerry Gygax still sells. Goodman Games with the Dungeon Crawl Classics. His stick is, let's make all the modules look like Keep on the Borderlands. That stick has worked great. I mean, like Deadlands, back when Shane and Matt Forbeck first did Pinnacle and Deadlands, the books were bright orange and bright green. That was a shtick. I mean, if you walked into a retail store, you noticed those books from, like, when you walked in the door, they started blinding you. And I always tell people, find a shtick. You know?
So here's a question for you, Aldo. Who in your mind, like, and let's not talk about Wizards of the Coast, because they have the Hasbro money, and, you know, WizKids has the Topps money, so let's not go there.
Okay.
But who is doing it right? Who do you think's doing a good job? Plug them. Give them some props.
Okay, let's just drop all the impressions clients and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, let's just forget talking about them. But outside, I really love what Fantasy Flight is doing. They are doing $80 games that are selling great.
Yeah.
And you get so much for your $80.
You do.
I mean, I opened up Descent, and I drooled. You know, I didn't even care. I didn't even know what the game played like. And I said, wow, I'm just going to love this game.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what.
Arkham was, I think, almost their pinnacle example of, like, bam, that's why you're paying $50 for this. You know,
it's interesting,
like,
that you
whoa.
Said that. I love the pieces parts of Arkham, but I actually didn't like it as a game. That
interesting. You know, you're the first person I've heard that from.
Well, that's the Cthulhu genre is not one of my favorite. I mean, I enjoy it, don't get me wrong.
Uh-huh.
But I think I only played it once. So I shouldn't say, too much about it. I should probably get somebody to, you know, teach me how to play it.
But, you should talk to Aaron.
Yeah, but Fantasy Flight, love Runebound, love Descent. I'm probably going to love Britannia just because of the theme, you know? It's like I love their board games. I think Fantasy Flight is doing it right.
I agree.
As one company. I'm going to give props to Zev at Z-Man Games again, because up until, of course, this year, I mean, he's burnt down at conventions, but he was doing it right. You know, pumping games at conventions and bringing in import. I mean, he's, I think, one of those guys that's really doing it right out there. I'm trying to think. I mean, other good medium-sized companies.
Well, what about an impressions client that seems to be doing it right or is following all of your advice and really?
Well, I mean, trust me, I would never say that all my advice is good, you know, but I try to tell people, look, you know, 10 people have done this and it hasn't worked. If you roll the dice, chances are it may not, it probably won't work for you, you know. But, I mean, Joseph Goodman at Goodman Games, he's smart as can be, you know.
Those guys are awesome.
You know, you say those guys, but, you know, Joe owns and runs the company and has freelance writers, you know, doing all this. The concept, like Joe says, I'm going to do something called Dungeon Crawl Classics and get people to write modules. And he does the concept. I'm going to do this complete guide series, and he does the concept. And actually, you as a retailer, you're going to get an opportunity to get a free spinner rack with a ton of his product at 20% off, and you get the spinner rack for free. And he thought of this promotion.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm going to give a retailer, if a retailer buys $500 worth of product from me, they're going to get that $500 and an extra 20% off at their distributor and get a free spinner rack. I mean,
that's fantastic.
It's going to be brilliant. And
yeah.
He thinks of these things all the time, you know.
That's
out of all my clients, I mean, I love my clients, don't get me wrong. Like I said, Kurt, Smirk and Dagger does things great, Steven Trollor does things great. I'm a big communication freak. So the clients I hear from are always two thumbs up for me, because we communicate, we talk. We always try to figure out together what's good and what's bad. But, you know, Joe just always comes up with great ideas, you know, out there.
I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb here and give Joe Goodman the award for most improved D20 publisher. His first things was like, you know, Dinosaur Planet. I wasn't really feeling it.
I don't think that was the name, but...
No?
It was Dinosaur Planet Bronchosaurus Rex, and we still sell it for
him. That's it.
Okay. So, and he has the Cretaceous Adventure Guide as well, which is the supplement. So,
yeah.
Lo and behold, and we had the complete guide to T-Rex, too, so...
But, well, before we jump into currently playing, do we have any last follow-up questions?
I got one. I mean, if Aldo wants to go there, who missed and had just a big shot recently? Who do you think? Who's messing it up and shouldn't be? You want to go there?
You're talking as a publisher?
Yeah.
As a publisher? I don't know. I mean, you know, could we... I mean, I'm not saying that it's wrong, but do you think... Let's talk about what's in the news that the consumers listen to. Out of the Box and Rio Grande. You know, is that missing it, or is that great?
You won't know until it has an effect.
That's hard to say.
I mean, I found... I didn't know what it meant. The press release was really super vague, right? So one of our distributors, you know, cleared it up for me and said, no, they're just acting as another distributor utilizing their channel, you know, in behalf of Rio Grande.
Yeah.
And... what it might mean is that what Uber Play had happened with Eagle happens again when they realize that the synergy just isn't strong, that their games are a little bit too confusing to go into the mass market. You know, it might tie up some of their product for a while. I don't know. I don't know if it's a bad thing or what, but it was a little bit strange.
Well, some retailers were saying that the bad out of it is that if the Rio product does get into the specialty game stores and the mass game stores, but the hobby game retailer like yourself may not carry those Rio products as much anymore because you can't compete with the price break that Target's going to put, you know, Carcassonne at.
I think that's such a short-sighted, you know, opinion because, you know, here in the Bay Area, we have hundreds of stores to compete with. We have all the Barnes & Noble stores. We have all the Target stores. We've got, like, 11 game stores out here. You know, and I, for one, would be loving seeing Carcassonne in Barnes & Noble, you know.
That's why I'm saying we don't know. I don't know. I was bringing it up just more as a discussion point. I don't know if it's good or bad either. I mean, personally... If I was a game publisher and some bigger game publisher came to me and said, hi, I want to help you sell more games and use my big channel for it, I'd be like, great, sounds good.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I really wish the other retailers wouldn't see this as the end of the world and see it as another opportunity to have these games, you know, in stores where people are going to walk by and go, oh, cool, yeah, I should go, you know, pick that up on my lunch hour at my local game store or something.
Yeah.
It works both ways sometimes.
Yeah, but you local retail stores like you guys really bring the advantage of, you know, game night, demoing product. I mean, no offense to any specialty retail store, Toys R Us, or Target, but you guys just have so much more knowledge of the product intimately.
Right.
So that's the big advantage. You'll still continue to come into your store.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, anything else that's wrong out there, I would actually pose the question to you, Chris, because I don't know as much in the miniatures market as I should, but people have been bringing up Games Workshop, raising their prices, and, you know, that's hurting things because... and just helping Privateer and Mongoose? Is that true? I'm actually looking to you for knowledge on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things we've gotten into a few times here. It's Games Workshop has a cycle of raising prices just about every 12 to 18 months, depending on the lines that we're talking about, meaning whether it's like their hobby products like paints or their other side of the house, which is their miniatures and books.
Uh-huh.
You know, last July, July 2005, they hit another big price increase, and it really, really, really soured the market again, you know, after it had just been soured by a price increase earlier that year. So their games got really expensive, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, in the last few years, these smaller miniatures publishers... like Privateer and like Rackham, kind of, and like Mongoose. There's competition out there for the first time that has models that are as good or better than the ones they're selling, and they're cheaper. And, you know, late last year, we find out that Games Workshop was down 20% over the previous year. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And and they've got investors to deal with, and, you know, they're telling their investors, well, it was because Lord of the Rings slowed down, and, you know, independent retailers just aren't stocking as much as, you know, they used to, and blah, blah, this and blah, blah. And then early this year, they raised prices again in England. So it was like, guys, you know, you made a crappy third game out of Lord of the Rings. It didn't sell. It's not going to sell anymore. Pull back and get some more damn Necrons out there or something. But yeah, I mean, they're struggling from a number of different angles, and, you know, much of it seems to be denial, you know.
I think the Necrons should have their own game.
Okay.
Just, you know, Necrons on holiday.
Necrons on ice.
Nicking.
Yeah. Oh, wait.
You went there, man.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
Thank you. Slam dunk.
But, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, quite honestly, still, the newer publishers and the small publishers, you know, they just need to get out there more so they don't make the mistakes. You know, because you ask me who's making mistakes per se,
uh-huh.
or who's not doing it right. And I'm not saying that they're doing it on purpose, but the newer publishers really need to get out there more. I mean, really hit the pavement when they're going to make a game, you know, get out there to the stores and get out to the conventions and all that other stuff. And they will very, very quickly get educated, you know, on what's great and what's not great to do with their product. But
and I'm going to jump in and quickly say, you know, for as much as I think GTS kind of sucks a lot, I'm going to tell these small publishers, get your asses to GTS this year in Vegas, drop the money, and go to some of these seminars that people like Aldo give about marketing your game to not only consumers, but the different style of marketing you need to market to retailers.
You know,
just go, drop the dime. It's an investment in your business. You can write it off on your taxes, but go take this advice, because we see so many people come and go in this industry all the time because we never even got a chance to hear from them in the first place.
And, you know, even this year, actually, and let, you know, I'm just going to plug it, my three seminars are actually seminar on marketing to consumers, marketing to retailers, and marketing to distributors. And each one's going to cover, I mean, who would ever think you'd have to market differently with those three different people? But you do. You know, it's just like the whole changing gears thing between a trade show and a consumer show. You know, there's just different sentences you need to say. There's different, you know, ways you need to act. There's different verbiage. You know, so at GTS, those are at minimum the three seminars I'm going to do that are on the schedule, and there's probably a couple others that I'm going to be on at the last minute because, I don't know, I really like hearing from new people, and obviously it's a great place for me to look for new clients, of course. You know, or try to get the next new great small press game, you know, that I could hopefully make money off of.
Right on. Right on. All right, well, we're gonna wrap up the show as we customarily do, and although we invite you to join in, what have we been playing in the last week? What have we been getting on?
Well,
Go ahead.
Aldo, you're first.
Yeah, I'm going to be first just because I said great things about Fantasy Flight. I've been playing the Rootbound and Rootbound expansions. Really happy about that. I actually just got a buddy of mine into Risk 2210, which I still think is so much better than the original Risk, and I'll never play the original Risk ever again.
Yes.
And then Memoir 44 from Days of Wonder and all the expansions. And, gosh, what other Fantasy Flight? I mean, Descent, of course. You know, and I bought the World of Warcraft board game, but we haven't played it yet, and I bought Warcraft and the expansion, and I haven't played that yet either. I even bought Doom from them, and I haven't played it yet either. So I've got a whole vat of Fantasy Flight games that I want to play that I haven't played yet. But those
Aldo, don't just skip the Doom. You were doing fine before that.
Yeah, I know. That's what everybody tells me, that Doom is like the predecessor to Descent. You know, Descent is the corrected Doom.
Yes.
So, but those are my big games these days.
All right, Chris, what have you gotten on lately?
Nothing.
Really?
We had a convention last Saturday and Sunday, and we were loading up a truck tomorrow morning for another convention this week.
Well,
so,
then.
We're busy.
Right on. Alan?
I've had my weekly D&D game, plus an extra session on the weekend, Carcassonne Hunters and Gatherers lately.
Oh.
And some Lord of the Rings FFG title.
Excellent. Oh, you mean the confrontation, or
no? I mean the original cooperative.
Oh, the Reiner Knizia collaborative Lord of the Rings board game. Okay, I feel certain that I played something in the last week, but I no longer remember what.
A really good game. Must have been a really good game.
So I'm just gonna have to check in with you next time, or I'll update the post or something. I really don't know what we got, but Chris, do you have any now playing our? New release updates.
Spit it out, boy. Spit it out.
Yes, getting there.
Yes, I actually have a new Fantasy Flight game this week, which is Fury of Dracula.
Oh, excellent.
I'm so excited about this one.
You are?
I love the old original GW version. And,
okay, I'm not familiar with it at all, so...
Yeah. Oh, it's more commonly known as the Furry of Dracula. It's basically you're hunting Dracula in board game form. I played it back in the late 80s, and I've burnt those brain cells away, so I couldn't tell you how gameplay actually works. But it was a good time. It was second only to Chaos Hordes, or whatever it was. The old GW board games are great. And
you have burned a few brain cells, I guess.
You're sounding more and more inebriated as you're going on.
Yes.
He's just high on Games Workshop.
Woohoo. It's a fine organization. Anyway, we finally got our Dogs in the Vineyard in. That was exciting.
Awesome.
We got the Penny Arcade Battle Box the new Universal System, or whatever it is.
It's Ultimate Fighting.
Yeah,
I came and looked at that at the store and went, I'll let Mike check it out first.
Yeah.
I will probably pick it up. I don't know that I'll ever play it, but I like the strip, so I want the cards.
All right.
So, let's see what else. We got the D20 Modern, the D20 Future tech book came in. If you like D20 Future and you need some more gear and spaceships and stuff like that, it's not a bad book at all.
I got that sample copy from Wizards of the Coast, and it came with Races of the Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
Did you just get that?
We've had it for about 2 weeks, yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's a good one. The Ars Magica Covenants book came in, and if I remember what Paul Tevis said on Half Games Will Travels podcast, I think he worked on that. So I looked through it only briefly, but that's a game that keeps impressing me. So
and shout out to Paul, definitely.
The most important release perhaps of 2006. Munchkin 4 Need for Speed.
Oh yeah. Yeah, we're huge fans of Munchkin. Oh wait.
I've got to throw the props for the title. I mean,
no.
Sure.
Yeah.
Munchkin fills its role in the world.
It does.
Yeah.
It's and it doesn't kick anyone's dog.
And it puts money in my pocket a lot. So Munchkin 4 Need for Speed released in 2006.
That's fine. Shout out to Munchkin.
Yep. And I think that's about it. We got a couple Hex Encounter games in, Command & Colors Ancients, and the Burning Blue Battle of Britain. So there you go.
All right. So shout out to Aldo Giazzi of Impressions Advertising and Marketing. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. And you kids down there, have a good DungeonCon. I'm gonna get nice and cozy with some honey, lemon, and scotch.
Nice.
So, yeah, let's call it. I'm Mike Sugarbaker.
And one more time before we go, don't forget about Endgame's April 1st Minicon. Details are up on RPG.net.
I'm sorry I forgot about that, Chris.
That's okay. I got myself on my own back on this whole thing. We're fine.
He's covered. This is Alan Sugarbaker.
I'm Chris Hanrahan with Endgame in Oakland, California.
Thanks again to Aldo for joining us.
Yeah, we'll definitely try to conscript him for another show later.
Yeah.
And see you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Thanks.